Tonight on Arena. In TV, we look at Dark Matter, Bodkin and Season 3 of Welcome to Wrexham. And we have separate musical performances from bass baritone Rory Dunn and trumpeter Tina Thing Helseth. Every year, towards the end of October, opera and art lovers descend on Wexford for the Opera Festival. Well, the programme for this year's Wexford Festival Opera has been announced. Booking for events opened today. The theme of the festival this year is theatre within theatre. Each year, Wexford stages three main stage productions of rarely performed operas, as well as a number of short opera works. Now, the three main works this year are Le Mascare, or The Masked Ball, by Pietro Mascagni, The Critic, by Charles Villiers Stanford, and an opera that I'm just going to call Viva la Mama, by Donizetti. This, along with two pocket operas, including a new work by Colm Tobin and Alberto Caruso, will make up this year's programme. I'm here in Studio 8, joined by one of the soloists in the Charles Villiers Stanford Opera, The Critic. He is Rory Dunn, bass baritone. He plays the role of the Governor of Tilbury Fort in The Critic. We'll talk to Rory in a moment, but first of all, we're going to hear him sing. Along with him is his accompanist, Aoife Moran, and they're going to perform Bella Siccome un Angelo from Don Pasquale by Donizetti.
Terra pellegrino, fresca si come il giglio che s'apre sul mattino. Occhio che parle ride, sguardo che cor conquide. Sorriso incantator, sorriso incantator. Alma innocente ingenua che se desmagnara, modesta impareggiabile, bontà che v'innamora. Ai miseri pietosa, gentil dolce amorosa, fatta nascere per far beato un cor, per far beato un cor. Il cielo fatta nascere per far beato un cor, per far beato un cor. Il cielo fatta a nascere per far beato, beato, per far beato.
Bella Siccome un Angelo from Don Pasquale by Donizetti, sung for us there by Rory Dunn, accompanied by Aoife Moran. That's it. That's a nice little gentle number for you from Donizetti. He really does the bel canto thing, Donizetti, even that little section where you sing by yourself.
Absolutely, yeah. It is, as said, on the tin, beautiful singing. And much easier to sing than a lot of things, although you need a good technique behind it. It always sounds easier than it is.
I was thinking that. Easy for you to say, it's easier to sing.
Once you have it done, it's easy. Although, A full role can be a bit of a nightmare to get to get under your belt of it, but it's I mean, it's lovely to hear. I love listening to Bel Canto.
Yeah, and I know that there is a Donizetti opera as part of the main set of operas this year in Wexford. I said in the introduction, Viva la Mama.
Viva la Mama.
Because I wasn't prepared to give the full title. I thought,
which is fair enough. Le Convenienze ed Inconvenienze Teatrali, which is the theatrical inconveniences and conveniences. It's a comic title, as you might guess.
Very long title.
Absolutely. I think it's probably one of the longer titles in the operatic repertoire.
I know you're not involved in that one, but the theme this year is theatre within theatre. And even the title there, you know, the convenience and the inconveniences of theatre or whatever, or theatrical inconveniences. What is there a theatrical theme in this opera?
Absolutely, yeah. So I think with all of the operas, it is this theatre within a theatre, but specifically within this one, it takes place in an opera house, and there are a cast of characters which it kind of rotates around, mainly the prima donna, the prima soprano, and the seconda soprano, and then the mother of the seconda soprano, whose head is budding with absolutely everyone, and then a German tenor as well, who doesn't know any of his words or where he is or anything like that.
Would tenors be like that?
Oh, I have no comment, I'm sure.
I know baritones would never do that. I would never behave like that. They're usually the heartbroken in the opera, aren't they?
So they're heartbroken because they don't get any of the lovely arias that the tenors get. They get some, but and they never get the woman either in the story.
Yeah, well, that's generally the case, that the Peral baritone has to sing that how much he loves the person that the tenor has just gone away with. So that's the Donizetti opera within this, and Le Mascagni, the mask ball from Mascagni. I'm guessing the same thing. We're in a world of masked characters, etc.
Absolutely,
et cetera.
Yeah. It's one of the older theatrical traditions of Commedia dell'arte. It's kind of an early pantomime in which each of the characters is a stock character, like the doctor, il dottore, or Pantalone, the fool, that sort of thing. And a servant, they all have their certain roles. And there's an interesting prologue in which they kind of communicate to the audience what they're about to do. And this kind of started that trend, which then took off, and it's in a lot of operas after that.
Now, the one in which you have the biggest role to play, and quite an important role to play, is The Critic by Charles Villiers Stanford, with a book, or the libretto here, by Richard Brinsley Sheridan, he of The Rivals, The School for Scandal.
Yes, absolutely. It's this is by far the most, I think, convoluted and intensely confusing plot of all of them, because while all of them have theatre within theatre, this one specifically takes place in a theatre, and so we have four actors, and they are watching another play happening within it, which I am one of the players in. It's just, but I mean, Stanford in its own way is just brilliant.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about the nature of Stanford music within it, because I suppose I associate him kind of with choral music. Choral music is important for him, isn't it?
Absolutely.
You know, so that vocal side of things is in there. And a kind of Irish romanticism of the period that he was writing.
I just did a recording with a Retrospect Opera and the Scottish Opera Orchestra of his most famous opera, Seamus O'Brien, last year. Myself and a cast of other Irish singers, actually, they tried to cast it entirely Irish so there could be a lot of all the dialogue, which is a kind of authentic and
Hiberno English. When you hear a title like Seamus O'Brien, I'm wondering, how Irish is
it?
Irish, is that opera?
Yeah, there's a lot of that, actually. I actually wrote an article for Gramophone about Stanford's Irish identity because, I mean, he even pulled the run of the performance of it when it was doing well, because he felt it stirred up Irish nationalism at the time, and he was quite against home rule and all that sort of things.
And just to give us a sense of the style of the singing, I mean, we heard you with that Bel Canto earlier on. How would you describe this style of Stanford?
Stanford, I never really know where to put my finger on it. I've had this discussion several times over the last year, specifically about Seamus O'Brien as well, where some of the arias can feel almost like Die Fledermaus, but then other arias feel like Offenbach and even more romantic settings of stuff. It's a hard one. I mean, I feel like his music doesn't really have a specific identity.
Yeah.
Or if it does, it's not very clearly apparent.
Doesn't jump out at you. Maybe that's that Irish English kind of
convolution. The man's life was full of duality, and I think his music is as well.
Is it anything? Is there anything Tom Waits type sounds in the midst of it?
I wish.
I was interested to hear that one of your favourite singers is Tom Waits, and when I heard you singing Bel Canto, I thought, well, he never heard Tom Waits singing Bel Canto.
No, yeah, absolutely. I think, I like to listen to a lot of different styles of music. I mean, because I don't think I started singing opera till I was maybe 23 or 24. So before that, I would have done a lot of cover bands, that sort of stuff, like The Doors, that sort of stuff. And then got very much into Tom Waits, and I still am. I think he's my favorite songwriter and one of my favorite voices as well, even though it sounds like his voice has been hung up in a smokehouse and run over by a truck a couple of times. I think it's just so full of expression and poetry.
All right. Well, listen, you're going to sing a second aria for us right now. Interested in this one. How much of a Munster rugby fan are you?
I would cheer for Munster every time that Leinster aren't playing.
I've spoken like a true Leinster man. that one. But have you sung this in any kind of Munster setting?
I have sung the role of Escamillo in Munster in the Cork Opera House, just at the end of last year. So as part of the Caro O'Sullivan Associate Artists Program, we did a four-hander with some actors. Mm. And it pretty much it's La Tragédie de Carmen, so it's a reduced version of Carmen, in which.
And were you singing in French or in English?
In French.
So you didn't have to sing stand up.
No, I didn't. Although I do know the words. If anyone's looking, if any Munster supporters are looking for anyone to sing it, I won't tell.
You won't tell your Leinster pals. Off you go over to Aoife once again. Thanks for speaking to us this evening, Rory. That's Rory Dunn, who is part of this year's Wexford Festival Opera, and here for Leinster, Ulster, Munster, and Ulster and Connacht people, he's going to sing the Toreador song from Bizet's Carmen.
Votre toast, je peux vous le rendre, Seigneur, Seigneur. Car avec le soldat, oui, le torero peut s'entendre. Pour plaisir, il se les combat. Le cirque est plein ces jours de fête, le cirque est plein des hauts en bas. Le spectateur perd la tête. Le spectateur s'interpelle à grand braqueur. Apostrophe, crise et appel, je pousse jusqu'à si la fureur. Car c'est la fête du courage, c'est la fête de chant de cœur. Allons, un quart d'heure, allons, allons. Toreador, en garde, toreador, toreador. Et songe bien, oui, songe en combattant, qu'un œil noir tourne au cœur. Dis que l'amour t'attend, toreador, l'amour t'attend. On fait silence, que se passe-t-il? Plus de cris céleste, le taureau s'élance en bondissant hors du taurif. Il s'élance, il entre-frappe, en chevarule, entraînant d'un picador. Après votre taureau, hurle la foule. Le taureau va, elle vient, et frappe encore. c'est quoi? C'est pas de rire. Plein d'effureur et le cœur, le cirque est plein de sang. On s'en sauve, on franchit le cri. C'est un heure maintenant. Allons, on garde, allons, allons. Toréador, on garde. Toréador, toréador. Et songe bien, oui, songe en combattant. Qu'un œil noir tourne au cœur. Dès que l'amour t'attend, toréador. L'amour, l'amour t'attend, toréador, toréador.
The Toreador aria there from Carmen, performed by Rory Dunn with Aoife Moran on piano. You can see Rory as part of the Wexford Festival Opera in The Critic, which opens on October the 19th. And for information on that and indeed everything happening at Wexford during the autumn Wexford Festival Opera, go to the website wexfordopera.com. And here we are now, back in our usual studio, and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. We're live streaming there. TV reviews now. Dark Matter is a science fiction series based on the 2016 best-selling novel of the same name by American author Blake Crouch. The show centres on the character of Jason Dessen, a physicist, played by Joel Edgerton, who is abducted into an alternative version of his own life and embarks on a harrowing journey to get back to his true life and save his family. He's married to Jennifer Connelly and they have a son, as in she's married to Jennifer Connelly's character. Next up, Bodkin, a comedic thriller starring Will Forte, Robin Cara and Siobhan Cullen, who spoke to us recently on the programme about Bodkin. It was filmed in West Cork, Wicklow and Dublin. First scripted TV series from Barack and Michelle Obama's production company Higher Ground follows a motley crew of podcasters who set out to investigate the mysterious disappearance of three strangers in an idyllic Irish town. And finally, Welcome to Wrexham, the Emmy Award-winning sports documentary, returns for its third season. The docuseries tells the story of the third oldest professional football team in the world, Wrexham, and the dreams and worries of the Welsh town when the club is bought by none other than Hollywood superstars Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney. With me in studio this evening, Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon, who are here to review the three series. We'll start with Dark Matter and Apple TV. I have to say, Chris, Jennifer Connelly, Joel Edgerton, you know, you get kidnapped and your life is, you're given an injection and suddenly there's an alternative reality. This is a good premise and this is a strong cast.
It is a good premise and it's a very strong cast. It's based on a novel from 2016 by Blake Crouch. Blake Crouch is actually adapting his own novel here. And yeah, I mean, look, that cast draws you in at the beginning. Joel Edgerton is leading the way and he plays a character named Jason Dessen who is essentially bored with his lot. And the Jason one we meet, and I'm giving him a number because there is going to be a Jason two. The Jason one we meet, he used to be a promising physicist. He had big ideas, big ambitions. He was going to change the world, but he actually decided to marry his high school or college student sweetheart Daniela, played by Jennifer Connelly. She runs an art gallery in Chicago. He decided to become a physics professor in Chicago. They have a teenage son, Blake, with the, or a charity.
They have a lovely family life.
They have a lovely family. It's a wonderful life, and there'll be a reason why I'm saying that. I'll explain that later on. But Jason looks a little bit glum. He's kind of thinking to himself, what if I had tried to change the world? What if I kept with the physics? And it doesn't help matters that an old pal of his, played by Jimmy Simpson, his name is Ryan, he seems to have won this very prestigious science prize. So he's on his way home from Ryan's celebration drinks and he's thinking to himself, it should have been me. Well, he's actually kidnapped that night by a master kidnapper who says to him that, you know, when you wake up in the morning, your life is going to be very different. And he's not lying. What happens is that he wakes up in a world that isn't his own. And in this world, he didn't marry Daniela. Daniela went off to be a famous artist. He actually kept with his own kind of studies and with his own theories and his own work. He became a world famous physicist. And while he's living this life and trying to figure out how he got into this world, the person who kidnapped him, who's also Jason, has gone into Jason 1's old life and is basically taking over. Very complicated.
So basically, and they're both played by Joel Edgerton. So you have Jason 1 is the real, if you like, the character we meet at the beginning of the series, and Jason 2 is the other guy who's the kind of
the shady Jason,
the alternative version who has taken over, is back along in the old life.
Evil Homer, like shady Jason, and then Jason 1, they're differentiated from each other because Jason 1 has a scar on his nose from
the
fight.
When he was kidnapped.
So that's how you remember which one is which. But also, you know, Joel Edgerton has this kind of tone about him when he's playing Jason 2, where he's a little bit rougher around the edges, a little bit more intense, which you kind of are thinking, well, does his family and friends not see that with him and not see that he is asking really strange questions, like, I can't remember our friend's surname, when he's, you know, looking desperately, scrambling through their Instagram to see who exactly his wife invited over for dinner and what they can talk about. And yeah, I mean, you also see there's a lot of like clunkiness to the introductory part of this, like, as in he is this physics professor, and I will say a very buff physics professor. If people were giving out about Jeremy Allen White being a very buff chef in The Bear, they've seen nothing yet with this physics professor. But then he's standing there teaching this class, and obviously it's belabored that he is teaching them about Schrodinger's cat. So it's like, this is foreshadowing, people. We know something is going to happen.
And dead at the same time.
Exactly. What is happening here? And I do feel like there is opportunity there to dig into, as you say, you've got this fantastic cast. You've got someone like Jennifer Connelly, who is never bad, and Joel Edgerton, who usually is never bad. And there is this adult kind of themes, like, as Chris was saying, it's about the road not taken, about, you know, chance, about destiny, about relationships, about how, you know, they can blossom, but also they can thwart your ambition. But none of that is kind of dug into enough. It's all very surface level, unfortunately. And it's, you know, the MacGuffin, the science, the multiverseness of it all kind of takes over from episode 3 onwards.
Let's have a listen to a scene between Jennifer Connelly, who's always Daniela, but she's either Daniela who became the wife of Joel Edgerton, or Daniela who went off and became a famous artist. So here she is with, she's still the wife at this stage, but it's Joel too who's pretending he's her husband, if that, I hope, makes sense to everybody. So here's a conversation between the two of them.
We hadn't seen each other for a while, and you showed up here one night out of the blue, said you'd been thinking about me. You really don't remember this. He told me that our existence is all about choices. You said our choices create worlds. And so, theoretically, we simultaneously inhabited an infinite number of them. He told me that in this world, the worst choice you'd made was the one you made with me. I said we'd had our moment all those years ago, and that I loved you. I always love you. Now we're friends. I'm in a different place, and you are too. We talked for a long time. You started talking about your research, and you mentioned a project that was under wraps. And you said something that struck me, so I remember it very clearly. He said, you'll probably never see me again.
There you go. In fact, it's just Jennifer Connelly. But it's a lovely echo of a scene. That's her in a scene from Dark Matter. It's a lovely echo of a scene where she says, well, you know, you said you kind of wasted your time with me. Whereas in the real world where he is, where the real Joel is married to the real Daniela, he has said to her, you know, I made a decision when I came to the end of my life, I wanted to have memories of you, not memories of a sterile lab. And you just think, that's a lovely, what a wonderful, wonderfully romantic thing to say. Does it become, it's always difficult when you're talking about these things because they're so confusing in terms of when you describe them. But when you're watching them, is it confusing?
I found it as it wore on. I mean, I think at the start, it's a pretty clear concept. But as it gets into, this is the lab where this, you know, item, this box basically was invented, it kind of gets a little bit more parallel universes, and then, you know, you see him kind of traveling through so many multiverses, and, you know, it really, I think, you know, we have to lay the blame for this glut of high concept sci-fi at the feet of the Riddler King himself, Christopher Nolan. And I think, you know, Dark Matter is Vanilla Sky by way of It's a Wonderful Life, by way of the multiverse shenanigans of something like Inception and even Tenet. And I just think that, you know, it feels like with this current crop of showrunners that the streaming giants think that audiences are dying for these naughty kind of complex conundrums, like watching that in their downtime. But I think it has an interesting premise, and it is, it sounds bold and it sounds very ambitious and philosophical in a way, but I also think it becomes willfully obtuse and kind of dull as it goes on, even though it ratchets up like kind of the drama and the tension of going into in and out of these multiverses where you see a different kind of Chicago and crazy things are happening. I think if you once you lose sight of those characters, the trio of characters and their friendship and the dynamics of their lives, you're kind of you're losing the audience then, I think, a bit, because you're just concentrating on the sci-fi elements of it.
Stars from you on it, Jen?
2.5.
2.5 is again right in the middle. What are you saying overall, Chris, stars?
I think we're inundated with like epic multiverse travels and tales on the big and small screen. So if you're going to keep doing that, then you have to stand out. You need to have, the show needs to have something special. And when we're talking about the plot there, and especially the fact that Joel Edgerton gets to play various different versions of the character,
That should be
so much fun. Yeah. But unfortunately, it's not, because they go too straight. They go too dark and too murky and too muddled with it. And I think it's a big problem that Apple has with its sci-fis and dramas at the minute, where they take a story which is very promising and they take a cast which they don't deserve and they put them into a series that should have been a film. The biggest problem with Dark Matter, I think, is that there's far too much of it. And also, I should mention very quickly the It's a Wonderful Life, which I mentioned when I was talking about the story. It is going out of its way sometimes to compare itself to It's a Wonderful Life. But I think the difference with It's a Wonderful Life was that it was charming. It explained enough that you didn't ask too many questions about the ridiculous setup with George Bailey. With this, it explains so much, you could hear it in Jennifer Connelly's dialogue there, that you start poking holes in the logic. And if you're doing that, then something's gone wrong.
You shouldn't be seeing the cracks.
Exactly. Yeah.
You don't want to see how the sausage is made.
We don't. No.
In whatever box they're making it in. In whatever multiverse.
All right. And stars, and I only want one set of stars, not a multiverse.
No. I'll go with two and a half out of five. And I will say this: Jennifer Connelly needs to stop playing the long-suffering partner of troubled geniuses. We had it in Hulk, we had it in A Beautiful Mind, we don't need it again. She deserves better, and I think we do too.
Alright, 2.5 from both of you. Episodes 1 and 2 currently available on Apple Plus. How many in total? Is it 8 or 6?
Is 9 episodes.
Nine episodes in totals, but 1 and 2 available now on Apple Plus. Let's move on then to Bodkin, which we're previewing. Darkly comedic thriller starring Will Forte, Robin Cara and Siobhan Cullen, who spoke to us recently on the show. You know, the easiest way to explain the setup here is she's in London as a journalist. An awful event takes place there where one of her colleagues dies, and a guy who she's doing this investigative journalistic piece on dies, and therefore her editor says, you know, off with you now to Ireland. I want you to be part of this podcast team. She hates podcasting.
Yes.
And here she is at the airport meeting up with the other members of her podcast team. Dove is Siobhan Cullen's character. Gilbert is played by Will Forte, and Emmy is played by Robin Cara.
But you know what's really sensational? Just listening to people tell their story. There's nothing more interesting.
Yeah, totally.
Right? The best stories are always mysteries. And there's only one true mystery. The human heart.
Wow. People will listen to that, will they?
Wait, Dove? Are you Dove? Oh my God, it's so nice to meet you. So Damien was telling me all about you.
Like what?
Good stuff. Yeah, good stuff. Do you know our researcher, Emmy?
I'm Emmy Souza. I work in the digital department. We've actually met a couple of times.
No, I don't think so.
Oh. So I've organised everything. Accommodation is sorted, interviews lined up. I've got maps. I've hired a driver for the week. Sean O'Shea. How Irish is that? I've actually been trying to learn Irish, which is a really difficult language.
Hey, this is going to be so much fun. Look at us, the dream team. Bodkin has no idea what's about to hit it.
There we go. That's Will Forte. Jason Edgerton. Will Forte, not in that parallel universe. Will Forte as Gilbert, Robin Cara as Emmy, and Siobhan Cullen as Dove in that. practically opening scene almost from the series, Bodkin. You can kind of sense where it's going here in many ways, Jen. We're going to get a pretty Irish look at the Irish countryside and at a small village. But there's a bit of darkness in here as well.
There definitely is. And you can see what they're going for in the way of the success of Only Murders in the Building, which is, you know, based around these like three misfits that come together, a true crime podcast, and insanity ensues. But then also it's kind of tapping into the fact that West Cork itself has been this runaway success of a podcast in reality. So you're mixing those two things together and you have that small town atmosphere. But yes, it is this kind of, the tone is a little bit, not all over the place, but like at the beginning, it kind of feels like a standard sitcom setup where you have Siobhan Cullen's character being this no-nonsense, hard-bitten, hard-boiled investigative reporter who doesn't want to be paired with this superficial, you know, Gilbert Power, who is like this plastic paddy, and he's there to find, you know, his Irish roots, and isn't it all great, and this kind of patronising notion of what Ireland and who Irish people should be. And it's all about kind of these outsiders coming into this town that have this very deep, dark secret about these three people that went missing at the Samhain Festival. They want to keep things secret. They want to put as many red herrings in the way of this podcast as possible. But also, you know, the strand is there that something bad and disturbing happen beneath all the kind of eccentric exterior.
Yeah, let's have a listen to another scene here. Chris Whalley is the Sean O'Shea, as she mentioned, or is it Seamus O'Shea, I think.
Sean O'Shea
is the driver. Can you get more Irish than that? Played by Chris Whalley here, and he's pulling up, he got the Bodkin team in the back of the car, and he meets two locals, John Olohan playing the character of Barry and Brendan Conroy playing the character of Cal. And here you get a sense of how they kind of, they overplay the Irish thing to get the, put them off the scent of the trail, really.
Barry.
Sean.
Carl.
Who's your friends?
You lads on your holidays.
Oh, no, we're here for work. We're making a podcast.
A podcast?
In Bodkin?
Mm-hmm.
And you do that for a job, making podcasts.
Sure.
And you've come from America to do a podcast in Bodkin. And people will listen to it.
Yeah.
They're doing some show about the lads that went missing in Samhain.
How about that whole thing?
Oh, did you live here when it happened?
Oh, yes. But, you know, it could have been anything. They were probably caught by a rogue wave.
A rogue wave?
My aunt got caught by one. Came up to our neck.
Hmm.
And, of course, if they were messing with the stones up in the hollow.
The stones? Are you touched?
Stones?
Fairies, Gilbert. He's talking about fucking fairies.
Listen, lads, be well, yeah? Stay out of trouble, Barry, yeah?
I hope it keeps fine feet.
Yeah, hope it keeps fine feet.
Hope it keeps fine for you. That's John Olohan, Brendan Conroy, Chris Whalley, Will Forty, and I think we heard the voice of Siobhan Cullen there. Apologies, I should have mentioned that. A little bit of language in the midst of all of that. And that gives you a sense of the kind of the Glick side of things. But there's a character played by David Wilmot. I've only seen the first episode, and David Wilmot brings this a really sinister quality, because you're thinking, what actually happened here? There is something that this town is burying.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not just the case of the town, because when the podcasters come in, you have some of the locals saying, you know, you're bringing unwanted attention to our town and we just want to forget about this horrible thing that happened 25 years ago or whatever it was. But there are clearly people who don't want podcasters there because they will see through them, and the outsiders will see through, you know, shadowy gangster types like David Wilmot's character, who's clearly involved in something dodgy. You know, we see him kind of exchanging brown envelopes. He scares Gilbert Power the minute, you know, the minute they meet in the pub. He has Sean O'Shea, played by Chris Whalley, who's the local taxi driver, clearly running errands for him. He goes missing at some stage. And also Dennis Conway playing this Garda sergeant who, you know, kind of tricks the podcasters into thinking that he's just a drunk who knows nothing, but he, you know, he's onto them. So there are some shady, shadowy characters there. It's very well cast. Will Forte, I like Will Forte's Irish screen adventures. He's popped up in Irish film and television shows before, like Extraordinary, a horror comedy, a couple of years back with Barry Ward. He was in Run and Jump by Alva Keegan. For some reason, he keeps coming in here and making some very interesting stuff. So, and this, you know, we can definitely add to the list. And I like to think that there might be some listeners there who will listen to the clips and say, oh, yeah, it's paddywhackery, oh, it's Irish stereotypes. I think it knows what it's doing in that it's leaning into those, it's leaning into that ridiculousness. You know, Gilbert Power is going there, you know, the American podcaster, wanting that storybook version of Ireland, and he's only delighted that he's getting it, but it's all a front. And I obviously won't spoil anything, I won't say give too much away, but I think it's basically, it's behaving a little bit like a satire, and I like the fact that Siobhan Cullen's Dove, she sees right through us. So we're sitting there at home watching this, rolling her eyes, but she's doing
rolling
that
them for us as well.
I thought that was
she's fabulous in this.
She gives good surly. Yeah. She really does. Yeah. And I think, you know, that is an archetype of a strong Irish woman that stretches back probably to the days of Peggy and Mike, and she does it so well, and she's sharp and cuts through all the blather of everybody else in the town. And I think with a show like this, obviously, like I always say, with something that has a comic kind of edge, it's very hard to base it on if you just watch the first episode. So I think you always need it to bed in a bit. Like I do think it deserves like the second, third episode.
I found myself at the end of episode one, I was kind of getting a little bit cheap, but then the David Wilmot character appears and you go, all right, there's something darker here. And I thought, I want to find out more. So I think you've both watched more than that. Will you continue watching till the end?
I mean, I think a lot of it, you do feel like the writer, Jez Scharf, he's throwing everything, the kitchen sink at it. You know, you have everything with this absurdist tone with like yoga nuns and, you know, semtex and eels. And it depends how much comedy you find in those kind of situations. Yeah. So I think if you're willing to go with it and willing, it kind of reminded me of this really underrated Australian comedy called Deadlock that had that same tone, that mixed the kind of true crime and crime with comedy. And if you're interested in kind of that area and taking, you know, the Mickey out of that kind of genre, you'll enjoy this. I think,
yeah, and
for
some
sure.
great actors in there. That Pat Short appears at certain
points.
He does.
Well, everybody's in there. Yeah.
Pat Short is like a genteel version of Tom from Father Ted. Like, his other character.
So
like,
we're on preview mode, so we're not in stars. But will you stick with this, Chris?
Yeah.
Is there enough there to kind of tease you to stay with?
Yeah, there's certainly enough in those first two episodes to kind of make you keep watching. And also, it's not every day that, you know, a former US president and first lady are name checked in the title sequence for an Irish set crime series. And also, it's a crime series for a change that's set in Ireland that, as I say, for a change, is not afraid to make fun of itself and is actually genuinely funny in places. And I do think we need more of that.
Please tell me somewhere along the way, somebody in the series says, "Is Fajr Ling," or we see it on a signpost somewhere along the way.
Or they go back to the plaza. They go back to the plaza.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So sounds as if you're going to stick with Bodkin and see what comes of that. Let's move on then to Welcome to Wrexham. Emmy Award-winning sports documentary returns for its third season, tells the story of the third oldest professional football club in the world, Wrexham, that was bought by Hollywood stars Ryan Reynolds and Rob McElhenney. And Chris, you know, you don't even have to be a fan of football, because I thought, these guys are just going to come in and throw money at everything. No, if you've watched any of season one or two, they are part of the community of Wrexham now. Yeah. You know, they're as if they grew up watching these football games their entire life.
It's extraordinary. And I think Rob McElhenney of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia and Ryan, Mr. Deadpool Reynolds, I think they thought it would be a funny joke at first that they would travel to Wales, a place they'd never been before. They would buy the third oldest football club in the world, Wrexham AFC. You know, they were inspired by the series Sunderland Till I Die. They were inspired. They were just fascinated and also just completely baffled by the English Football League promotion thing where, you know, if you're in the last three of one league, you're demoted. If you're in the top three of the next one, you're promoted. That was just, you know, nonsense to them. So they wanted to know more. They went over with their checkbooks. They put £2 million on the table. They knew that Wrexham AFC was in trouble, that they were in the National League. They hadn't been part of, you know, the
upper, outside of the major football league.
I was going to say that for the uninitiated, the National Football League is four rings down from the Premier League. Yeah. So it would take them a few years to get back to the Premier League. They hadn't been in there for a decade. But they put £2 million in. They were voted in, and they also brought a camera crew. So they've been documenting this. And also, it was just such a surprise to see that they decided to take it seriously, that they really did put money into it. They put interest, and they weren't just there to improve the football squad. They were there to improve the community. And I know it sounds as if I'm sentimentalizing this. I'm not. They did that for themselves. But it has worked out amazingly well for them. It's worked out for Rob and Ryan because the club has been promoted twice. They're actually in next year, they'll be going into League One. They got out of the National National League, and it's worked out very well for the directors and producers because they've got an Emmy Award winning show out of it. So season three brings us into the end of last year's football season when Wrexham AFC, they were promoters. They start coming up against teams that are significantly better than them. Sometimes they're just not used to it. They're signing new players. They've got James McLean, the Irish player, on board. They're going on their first tour of America. They're actually realising that there's an international audience for them now outside of Wales.
They do this big tour of America playing the big premiership teams, you know, like who are three rungs, four rungs.
LA Galaxy, Man United.
Let's have a listen to a discussion here. Wrexham managers Philip Parkinson and the Wrexham executive director Humphrey Kerr and Ryan Reynolds are discussing the aforementioned Irish winger James McLean, who is joining the team.
So when we're in America, obviously we were looking for someone to compete with Jacob Mendy in that left wing back position. And then we started looking at James McLean. So I started watching him and I thought, well, he's like by far the best player we can get in that position.
He's an iconic Irish footballer. I love watching him. God, what a scrapper. It's game time.
Here we go. I'm the stage in my career where I want something that's going to excite me. And the Wrexham one ticked all the boxes. People want to be remembered as part of history. So if we go on to achieve the success, then obviously I'll be a part of that history and look back with a great sense of pride.
There we go. Ryan Reynolds and Phil Parkinson and director Humphrey Kerr talking about taking James McLean onto the team. I think the Ryan Reynolds Marmite is getting at you here, Jen, is it?
Always, always. I always feel with Ryan Reynolds, and people are always like, oh, he's so funny on Twitter, blah, blah, blah. I feel like he always comes with a writer's room that are prepping his jokes. And it never feels natural to me. He's always on. He's always, you know, I don't feel like there's a real person. And, you know, this show is about real people and it's about the real community and it's about the, you know, under the gloss and the grit and determination of a working class community and how football, what it means to them. But I feel like with making it international, with making, you know, America sit up and watch this, it's a feeling of they want it to be Billy Elliot all the time. They want these funny people with their funny accents and their strange faces to cry for them and perform for them. There is a slight edge to that now on season three where I'm like, these are not performing monkeys, they're actually real people. And there's that slight edge to it that makes me uncomfortable.
You got a little bit uncomfortable.
I feel like it's like Succession where Roman Roy was trying to buy the football team for
his dad.
It always
does.
And I feel like they'll never truly understand it. They're always going to be the outsiders looking in. And I do wonder to myself, you know, the scrappy underdog element, if that disappears and if the attention of the public wanes and what does that mean for the team and what does that mean for the community when the cameras stop rolling? What will happen then?
Because they had a big success last year and they're starting out.
And they're building
kind of looking,
and looking
for more success.
But will people just go, oh, I'm not watching this anymore? And then what happens then to the community? And what happens then with Ryan Reynolds? And will they just, you know, take that injection of cash and
maybe
move
that's,
on?
That, you know, maybe that is goodbye to Wrexham.
Maybe that's the BBC documentary that happens
afterwards.
After the
event. All right, stars though, and would you stick with it? Would you say people should stick with it?
I like the interest in the girls' squad as well, and I think it'd be nice to have a spin-off for that. And I do think, you know, funnily enough, the trajectory that it follows, it feels like it's scripted because, you know, they have got this oomph and this drive and things have changed for them, which is unbelievable in itself. So we'll give it a three, I have to say, even with reservations.
Okay, Chris?
I think it may have appealed to non-football fans before, but three seasons in, I think maybe those non-football fans will drift away and that it'll be Wrexham that's watching this. And I would also say, watch that baggy runtime. Part of the appeal of the first and second season was that it was all 25 or 30
minutes. Yeah, I've noticed that. First
it goes
episode,
on
48
a bit.
Minutes.
There's no need for it. Yeah. But look, I think it does everything it's supposed to. It does it reasonably well. I would like Jen, like, you know, like an awful lot less sarky Ryan Reynolds humour. So I'll go with they can have 3 stars.
3 stars, okay. Chris Wasser and Jen Gannon then, looking at the following series. First two episodes of Dark Matter, which are out on Apple TV Plus today. Bodkin, which premieres on Netflix on Friday. And the first two episodes of Welcome to Wrexham Season 3 are available now on Disney Plus. Picking up the trumpet at the age of 7 in a school band, Norwegian trumpeter Tine Ting Helseth has championed the instrument and its repertoire amongst audiences on all 6 continents, meriting the critical praise for her soulful, lyrical and sound and her collaborative approach to music making. Tina's ever-expanding repertoire ranges from the classical period through contemporary works and indeed new commissions. She has been the recipient of numerous awards, including the first ever classical artist to win Newcomer of the Year at the Norwegian Grammy Awards. Award-winning solo trumpeter Tine Ting Helseth is joining the Irish Chamber Orchestra for the first time in a concert called Trumpet Sands, and I'm delighted that Tina is in our Limerick studios this evening to play for us and to talk a little bit to us as well. And let's get the Norway bit up and front and out there straight of all, because I think you have a piece of Edvard Grieg ready for me, Tina. Have you to play?
I do, yeah. First of all, it's very nice to be here on the show and nice to be in Limerick. Yeah, I'm very excited about this. So, yeah, I have a piece that we're actually going to play in the concert that I'm going to play with the orchestra, but now I can do it solo. Yeah.
And are you happy just to go straight into it now?
Sure. Well, I will just make myself ready and you'll hear it's a cow call, actually, that Edvard Grieg, you know, the most famous Norwegian composer, that he collected different tunes around, and this is then a traditional cow call.
Okay.
Yeah, that he collected.
Absolutely beautiful, the music of Edvard Grieg there. Cowkeeper's Tune and Country Dance. I'm guessing that is the Cowkeeper's Tune that we just heard from Grieg's 2 Norwegian airs, played live in our Limerick studios this evening by Tine Ting Helseth. It really struck me listening to that. It's one of the qualities, I think, Tina, about the trumpet that is forgotten all too often. That I almost saw a lonely cowherder up on a hillside singing this
plaintive for the cows,
but it's such a plaintive sound. You know, we're inclined to think, oh, the trumpet fireworks and you know, fanfares and all of that style to it, but that melodic side, I presume, was one of the things that really attracted you to the instrument.
Absolutely. And the trumpet can do so much different stuff, and you know, maybe a lot of people think of it sometimes as like this, you know, the fanfare, loud and fast, and you know, and stuff like that, and a lot of people think of it in like jazz and stuff like that, but it has this, what's always been kind of my favorite thing to do, and it still is, it's just to play a beautiful tune. It's like I could do that, like, if I got to do that for the rest of my life, then I would, you know? I just think there is something so rewarding also for me as a musician to just kind of figure out how to play a simple melody in the most honest and personal way, and just sharing that with the audience.
Yeah, because and that single line that obviously you have in a wind instrument like that, it means that it is very much like the singing voice. It has that quality to it. In fact, your own mother played the trumpet. You'll be telling me next that she played you lullabies at night on the trumpet to set you off to sleep.
Well, I, you know, my mother, yeah, she played the trumpet. So she's not a professional musician, but, you know, as her hobby. I mean, we have such a strong wind and brass band tradition in Norway. So that's why I started. My mom and dad played as a hobby. And when I grew up, I thought everyone played an instrument or a wind instrument or percussion. So it was the most natural thing for me to do. I mean, I always wanted to play the trumpet. And yeah, I guess I heard it from before I was born even. Yeah. So it always was something very close to my heart. But of course, I didn't want to hear, you know, what my mother said. I wanted my own teacher, not my mom. That was too close.
That was, too close for comfort. But you mentioned there the tradition of the wind band, excuse me, in Norway.
Yeah.
Particularly when I hear that more melodic style of playing, it makes me think very much of, you know, the English brass band tradition.
Absolutely.
In and around the collieries, particularly in the north of England. Were wind bands associated with a particular area of Norway or a particular jobs set within Norway, or how did they work as community work bands?
Well, I mean, it's a bit. So we also have the kind of brass band tradition, especially on the West Coast, that is, you know, like the English. That's where it came from, England. And then they play, you know, the cornets and horns, and they don't have the woodwind and stuff that we have in the wind bands. But the wind band tradition actually comes from the military bands in Norway, that has this very strong tradition, and they started to kind of, you know, they inspired people then to do this as their hobby, to have their own band in every city. I mean, there is a lot of bands playing still. And it's a hobby that, you know, kids play, grown-ups play. It's a very, I don't know, for me it was one of the best ways of having a good, nice hobby, you know?
And I mean, I think that community aspect of a wind band like that, where, you know, people of all levels and abilities can play in the band like that, because
Absolutely. You
have a first cornet and you have a second cornet and a third cornet, so, you know, you don't have to be an expert to play
No, not at all. Yeah. And a lot of the social and just doing something together. And I think that's, I kind of also envy the people that just play because they want to and they like it. And then they, you know, they have their other job. I do like it, but it's also my job. So sometimes I'm so fascinated and so inspired by seeing the people that just play because they want to.
Mm. What is the balance like, and particularly with the chamber orchestra? Now, there probably are some winds added in for this, for your concert, but the chamber orchestra, essentially a string orchestra. How difficult a balance is that to strike in the arrangements that you've chosen for the concerts?
Well, actually, for this program, they are only strings and me. And so we do one piece that is original, we call it original for trumpet players. It's actually a horn concerto, but that's a long time ago. So now we've kind of, it's ours now by this Czech composer. It's like this in the middle of Baroque and classical, kind of. So Neruda is his name. So we do this concerto that is only with strings originally. And then we do some arrangements of some Greek songs, and we do some Piazzolla.
I have a little bit of the Neruda playing underneath
this. I hear it now in the background.
Because there's a whole 22 bars, I think it is, before the trumpet before the trumpet gets in.
So yeah, getting ready.
It's the third movement. So I do want to hear it just when the trumpet comes in, which I think is about now. Well, I hope it's about
now. It's very soon now.
Yeah.
It's only a couple of bars left.
Here we go. And how beautiful is that? Just a little flavour of the Neruda Trumpet Concerto, which is what Tina Thing Helses will be playing with the Irish Chamber Orchestra at the upcoming concert. And it struck me, you said that was a horn concerto originally, but now it's quite, you're very clear it's a trumpet concerto at this point in time. Is there a paucity, is there a scarceness of repertoire for the trumpet, Tina?
Well, I mean, we do have some beautiful repertoire, but it is limited compared to violinists or pianists or some stuff like that. So, I mean, me personally, I really like the process of playing music that is for other instruments or song or the voice, or I want to play it just because it's nice music and then I want to do it too. So that's a bit, you know, with the Greek songs that we do and also with the Piazzolla stuff we do, it's not original for the trumpet.
But of course, but you arranged for it. Have you ever played a Joni? I know you're a huge Joni Mitchell fan. Have you ever played a Joni Mitchell song on the trumpet?
I have actually, I've both been playing and singing a bit that I also do, jazz and pop and those kind of things. I have played both sides now, with strings actually on a flugelhorn. That's quite nice with the soft sound. And
I was going to ask you about that. Do you move across? I mean, because it struck me with the Neruda that perhaps that might have been on a higher. It might have been on the E flat instrument sometimes.
Are you a trumpet player?
I have a little bit of knowledge. A little bit of knowledge, but a little bit of knowledge is a dangerous thing.
It sounds like a pro to me. No, that is the E flat trumpet. We do like it's in E flat, so it's kind of like a higher pitch. But then, my favorite instrument is my C trumpet,
which is a bit lower.
A little bit lower. And then you have like a flugelhorn that has more like a softer, bigger sound. So we have different instruments that we play for different repertoire.
Well, listen, lovely to speak with you this evening, Tina, and
you too.
All the very best for the upcoming concerts. I'm sure they'll be very exciting indeed.
Thank you.
And I will mention to people as well that you have a wonderful album with your ensemble, which is called She Composes like a Man, which is all full of female composers and arrangements for trumpet. Absolutely gorgeous. I was listening to some of them today. And people should check that out. But in the meantime, Tina Thing Helseth, live in concert with the Irish Chamber Orchestra, Trumpet Sounds. Two dates, Thursday the 9th of May at University of Limerick Concert Hall and Friday the 10th of May at the Royal Irish Academy of Music in Dublin. Full details can be found on the Irish Chamber Orchestra website, irishchamberorchestra.com. And that is our lot for this. Is it Wednesday? No, it is, yes. That's the part of the week we're at. Stephen Higgins was the broadcast coordinator, Niall Fitzmaurice and Paula Shields research. James Feeney was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Talk to you tomorrow night once again at 7 o'clock, and John Creedon will be with you after the news.